Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined by the former governor of the state of Massachusetts, Bill Weld. Thank you for coming in. I appreciate it very much.
My pleasure, Charlie.
Well, you know, people keep asking, is there going to be a primary challenge to Donald Trump? And the answer is you're already in it. You may not be the last one, but you're in it.
Well, I've formed my exploratory committee. I intend to pull the trigger on the final decision in the month of April.
Okay, well, let's talk about this. I have to ask you, because you and I were talking before we started, and the amount of travel that you're doing. You're going up to New Hampshire on a regular basis. You obviously have to travel around talking to various groups.
Oh, I would get around the country, and certainly the fundraising part of it is a national effort as well. But I've kind of done that before a couple times, sometimes for other people, and I've had several statewide races myself. So, you know, beyond a certain point, the adrenaline kicks in, and you just don't get tired at all.
Well, see, now that's what I was asking you, because, you know, I go back and forth between Wisconsin and D.C., and at by the end of the week, I am just drained out. So I always wonder how the presidential candidates do it, and the answer is the adrenaline.
Oh, yeah. No, that's completely true.
But you get tired of airplanes.
No.
And hotel rooms? You don't.
No, you don't. I never understood what Walter Mondale meant about I don't want to stay in an endless succession of Holiday Inns. If I've got a bed to sleep in, I feel I'm well out of it, well off.
So you're like Beto. You were born to be in it.
Oh, I didn't say Beto said that. I didn't say that.
Well, let's talk about this. What kind of reception are you getting up in New Hampshire? You're a two-term governor, former two-term Republican governor of the state of Massachusetts. But you have a somewhat checkered political past. You went to work for you aligned yourself with a Democratic president. You endorsed a Democratic president. Am I right about that?
No.
No, you did not endorse Obama.
Oh, Obama. Yeah, I thought you were talking about Hillary Clinton.
No. She never made it. No.
Yeah. So, no, I was with Romney all the way in '08, and after he lost the primary, that was part of what impelled me. I also had high hopes for President Obama. Thought he could have been really epical.
And then, of course, you ran as the vice presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party last year.
Right.
Not last year, in the last election,
yeah.
2016. Yeah. A lot of folks thought that maybe that ticket should have been inverted.
Well, we were encouraged to do that. But Gary, to be fair, had been running for president for 5 years. He was the Libertarian nominee in 2012, so I could see why he didn't have too much appetite for that.
Yeah, but you would have known what was going on in Aleppo.
I have had a lot of international exposure, both when I was in the Justice Department and when I was governor. I led 16 trade missions all over the world. And the last 15 years, I've had a lot of international business exposure, and I'm a member of a former heads of state organization that I got elected to just because the sole U.S. member is Bill Clinton, and he, for obvious reasons, doesn't always show up for the meetings, and they want to make damn sure they have an American to kick around. So, but that's pretty high cotton, as we would say if I was in Mississippi, to associate with a whole bunch of former presidents and prime ministers.
So what are you now? You've endorsed Democrats. You've been a Republican elected official. You ran as a Libertarian. How do you describe yourself?
I describe myself as a member of the Party of Lincoln, the Republican Party having at least a couple of faces. But you know, when I first worked in this town in Washington, I worked for Senator Jack Javits of New York. And it was a wholly different time and different feel. You know, people worked across the aisle. If somebody was going to give a big speech in the Senate, well, the galleries were filled with people who wanted to hear the speech and see whether they would be persuaded. It was a wonderful time to be in Washington. I was writing Senator Javits's speeches on Latin America at the tender age of 22. And those days are kind of gone. I mean, I think it started in 1994. And has gotten worse in terms of, the almost hatred between the parties in this town. And it's not constructive, and it's structural. I mean, I know a lot of the members personally. They're intelligent. They're good-hearted. They're good people. But they're in this system that I sometimes call a death spiral embrace, where the two parties need to demonize each other so they can scare their own base and raise a lot of money and get reelected. And at the end of the day, the terrible thing is people are obsessed with getting reelected. I would never be. I was president of U.S. term limits when I was in office.
Well, I'm going to drill down a little bit on this ideology. So you got your start with Jacob Javits, who would be described as sort of a Rockefeller-type Republican. Back and then, feel free to disagree with me. If you think
I never use that word.
Okay, you never
use that. In Massachusetts, we say Bill Weld Republican.
Okay, Bill Weld Republican, which was a sort of more liberal, moderate, progressive type of Republicanism.
You know, I never describe myself, Charlie, as a moderate because economically very conservative. I cut taxes 21 times. I never raised them. I cut spending in real dollars. I was ranked the most fiscally conservative governor in the United States by both the Wall Street Journal and the Cato Institute. So that's for openers. And, you know, it's true that on so-called social matters, I'm more, whatever word you want, welcoming, tolerant, open. But my political philosophy is a small government philosophy summed up in one sentence in my remarks to the Republican National Convention in 1992, which is, I want the government out of your pocketbook and out of your bedroom.
Okay, so the segue to libertarianism was easy for you.
I was always there. I mean, back in law school, I fell in love with Friedrich Hayek, who's one of the high priests of libertarianism. His book, The Constitution of Liberty, I thought was just fascinating. So, you know, I've never been someone who wanted to beat up on other people. You know, the libertarians think everything's about the individual and they're kind of anti-government in general. So am I. I mean, I'm aware of the good things government can do and I've done a lot of them. But my motto when I was in office is there's no such thing as government money. There's only taxpayers' money. And I lived that.
Okay, so you're sitting at home in Massachusetts. You're watching what's going on. Where did you come up? What was the moment where you said, "You know what? I have to do this. I'm going to quixotically. I'm going to tilt at this windmill."
Well, I think we know a lot more about how Mr. Trump would act in office now than we did 2 years ago. And I think, you know, the day after he was elected, I would not have raised my hand and said, "Let me be the standard bearer to reverse all this." But now we know that he very erratic personal behavior in office. What I voiced concern about in the 2016 cycle was his stability to hold the chief executive office in the land, and nothing has caused me to see fit to change that opinion. I think his personal conduct has been very reprehensible, picking on little people. The attitude towards women, come on, don't tell me 13 women who never met each other simultaneously decided to allege that then candidate Trump had groped them and worse, and he said all 13 of them are lying. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of those were quite successful women in their own right, and they had to have a certain amount of courage to speak up, but he couldn't tell the truth, right? And, you know, he's somewhere between a loose man with the truth and a stranger to the truth. And that, frankly, is pretty galling to me as a role model for our children and grandchildren.
So people must have been telling you, look, there's, you know, I don't disagree with anything you just said, but there's no way that he's ever going to be defeated in a Republican primary, right? I mean, people
well,
told you this, right? They cite the polls.
Sure they say so that. No one knows better than I do.
And you disagree.
Well, I do disagree. And a poll is a snapshot in time. When I started running for governor, I wasn't even an asterisk in the polls. Everyone said, you can't possibly win. This is ludicrous. And I just outlasted them, and I won. And the first time I ran for office, I was 32 years old. I ran for state attorney general. I was beat 80-20, you know, and the next time out, I won all the marbles. So you don't know. And particularly is that true this year when there are a lot of shoes in midair still, as no one knows better than I do after my 7 years in the Reagan Justice Department.
So what is it that I don't know about you? What is it? People will remember. Okay, I remember when Bill Weld was a thing back in the 90s.
Most people don't know I was a Grateful Dead fan.
Really?
But that's a true fact.
You're a deadhead.
Well, I wouldn't quite say that, but I'm a big music buff, and you know, the Stones and the Beatles, and that morphed into the Dead, and all the way up to the current day. Jason Mraz was a favorite of mine, so I even have some of the more topical names. But, you know, I, like the millennials, I want music and art in my life. I want things other than my workplace. I don't want to work 50 years for Mitsubishi and hope for a gold watch. You know, that's the old school, old style.
So someone was describing you to me and said that one of their concerns was that you were too laid back. And I have to tell you, you're not presenting that way right now. You seem like you are leaning forward.
Oh, no, I'm leaning into this one.
You mentioned adrenaline, like, right through the door.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, you got to be psyched to do this one, because there's a lot of people who say, oh, kid, you'll never get anywhere with this. And I happen to disagree with them, and I think I have the experience that suggests that it doesn't do to have that untutored view that you can't fight City Hall, things don't look good, therefore they're never going to change. 6 months is an eternity in national politics. And don't tell me it's not. So we'll see you in 6 months if you want to argue about a February, March 2019 poll.
Now, I mean this in a positive way, but you showed up here today without an entourage.
I did.
There's no staffers, no people buzzing around. So are you going to have a full-scale campaign?
Yeah, I do. Like when I go to New Hampshire, we have staff. I just hopped on the 7 o'clock plane this morning to go to Niskanen and then come over here, and I'm going right back to Mass.
Yeah, now they're an interesting group, because they would not be at the libertarian wing of the whatever the conservative movement
were all R's in that room.
Yeah, exactly. So tell me, what kind of reception are you getting in New Hampshire? You're going up to New Hampshire. How many times have you visited?
Five.
Okay, so what kind of are people going, how dare you challenge the Orange God King, or who are you?
Only one guy, and I don't know him, never met him, but the head of the state party, who's under direct orders from the White House and the RNC, do not let their be a primary, and you know, if they had their preference, they'd rather not have an election either. But that didn't go down so well in New Hampshire, believe it or not.
Not a sign of confidence, right, that they basically wanted to rig the system against
you. They sent out memos. This is what to do if somebody representing Bill Weld shows up at a Republican town committee meeting or a city committee meeting. Move to adjourn. If that fails, then move to change the subject. If that fails, then adjourn without a vote. They just are afraid that somebody representing Bill Weld is going to say something, anything.
Did they put this in writing?
Oh, yeah.
They put it in writing?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, I tend to suspect it's gone to all 50 states. And anyway, the guy who said, you're not welcome here in New Hampshire, was Mr. Trump's state chairman. He's now the chairman of the state Republican Party. And his motion to have the party abandon its neutrality and not have a first-in-the-nation primary failed for want of a second. They're smart enough in New Hampshire to understand that a good part of their clout nationwide rests on having the first-in-the-nation primary.
Yeah, my sense was that New Hampshire voters are kind of ornery sons of bitches, and that they wouldn't take to that sort of thing.
Well,
that it would backfire.
I don't know about the former. I mean, I've
that was my words, not yours.
I've been going to New Hampshire my whole life, and my personal motto could well be described as live free or die. So I'm right at home in New Hampshire.
Okay, so what else? I mean, are you sensing that there is an appetite? One of the strange things about the polls has been that Donald Trump may get, 83. You mentioned their snapshot, 83% approval ratings, whatever. But when you ask people, are you open to a challenge? You get a rather large number. I think maybe 40.
Something between 30 and 45%.
Right, 30 and 45%. Are you encountering are there Weld curious?
Oh,
Republican voters?
I think in New Hampshire there are a lot of Weld curious voters. So I've had 3-4 town halls, almost no hostile questions, and a lot of thank you so much. And some of them, I would think if you took a poll with me leaving the hall, it'd be 95%. So we'll see. I mean, I've got a year to do this, and I can meet a lot of voters and do a lot of town halls and go to a lot of house parties and do a lot of street walking and diner hopping in 12 months, and I plan to do so. And I'm also not a guy who has to go to Cabela's to buy my outdoor outfit before I show up and show my face in New Hampshire. I'm a lifelong hunter and fisherman and authentic outdoorsman. You know, I sometimes say the outdoors is my cathedral. And it's true. Environmentalism has been a long suit of mine. I think the president walking out on the Paris climate agreement and meeting and saying that climate change is a hoax. I mean, it's typical of this president to just fling around a buzzword, and that's the extent of the analysis. It's troubling in the Oval Office.
Do you get people who, or at some point you're going to get people who say, are you really a Republican? You ran as a Libertarian. You endorsed Barack Obama. How do you get over that?
Well, I was the most fiscally conservative governor in the United States. Okay, so I'm open on social issues. I'm not, I'm not a finger wagger. If the Republican Party was more open, it might have done better in the midterm elections.
Okay, so
in my humble opinion,
social issues. So legalizing marijuana.
I'm all for it. I think I've come around on that.
Gay marriage.
I think cannabis. It's been proved that it has medicinal value. Mm-hmm. Gay marriage, I was on both those issues. I came out in favor of medicinal marijuana and gay and lesbian rights in 1991, my first year in office. And on the medicinal marijuana, I was in all by myself for 15, 20 years. And on the gay rights, I was all by myself for 15 years. It didn't trouble me. I know my own mind and I call them like I see them.
Abortion, right to life.
Well, I'm pro-choice personally on abortion, but half my votes in Massachusetts were pro-life votes because I didn't run around, rubbing anybody's nose or anything. I just said, this is my view. It has to do with who, gets to make a decision. One of my wife's in my five pregnancies, there was an issue, and frankly, I think the medical community thought maybe that pregnancy shouldn't go to term. And we said, are you kidding us? Drop dead. Well, that was our decision. We got to make the decision. That's how I like it.
Okay, so tell me about Donald Trump. What do you say about Donald Trump? What is it about him that makes you feel that he needs to be denied renomination?
Well,
Donald Trump domestic?
Donald Trump domestic, I don't think he's doing the job that could be done. I was in favor of the tax cut. I think the tax cut did create jobs. I'm a supply-sider in economics, like a bunch of Donald Trump's people. But they're so caught up in all their controversies that they're not worrying about things they should be worrying about. For example, in the next 15 years, we're probably going to lose 25% of the existing jobs in the United States because of robotics and drones and artificial intelligence and machine learning and autonomous vehicles. In 36 states, the number one job category is driver. Long-haul trucker to delivery driver. Those are going to be gone in probably less than 15 years. There will be replacement jobs, but they're going to demand certain technical skills that those displaced workers won't have. So I think we should do a national program in partnership with the states to make 2 years of post-secondary education free to those displaced workers. That's not that many people. It won't be that expensive. But it's got to be done. It's like what Congress did at the end of World War II, the so-called GI Bill for returning vets. Very successful program. It was kind of a voucher. I have in mind the same thing for these displaced workers. They should be Trump voters, and he's not doing anything for them.
So you supported the tax cuts, but you're also a fiscal conservative, and we're now seeing a Republican president presiding over literally $1 trillion a year deficits.
He just added $7.9 trillion to the deficit.
Yes.
So it's now up at $30 trillion.
Which is stunning.
My view about how to handle a budget is spending cuts come first. And the reason I was voted fiscally most conservative is because I cut spending in real dollars year over year. The fact that President Trump's first veto is of this, a few billion dollars for the border wall by Mexico means he didn't veto $1 of the $2 trillion in deficit that was added on his watch. So he's not serious about keeping spending in check. And the fact that he's adding another $8 trillion to the deficit over the next 10 years shows he's not really serious going forward.
Is this going to be a big issue for you, going after them on the deficit?
Huge issue.
And the debt.
So, and by the way, it's another issue that's important to millennials because they're going to pay that deficit and they're not going to have Social Security.
But what will you cut? What do you cut?
You have to zero base the budget. This is a little bit in the weeds, but the way I did it is you have to assume that the appropriation this year starts at zero unless the program can justify itself from results last year. In other words, you measure outcomes, not input. The input is last year's appropriation. In Washington, they get together, and the Dems want to raise social spending 5%, and the Rs want to raise military 5%. And after a big, huge fight, they get together and compromise by raising everything 10%. That's what they do in Washington, D.C. And they're just not serious about balancing the budget.
But what about the entitlements? How do you do without going after? I mean, there are some reductions in spending in Medicare, and you know, of course, what the Democrats are saying about even what Trump is doing, and Trump is not serious about reforming entitlements.
No, I don't think he really is. I don't think he's really willing to take any tough steps. I think in health care, there's no consensus in Congress about the Affordable Care Act. There are things that we should do to put more power in the hands of people and their doctors, which is what I think we should do. We should allow individuals to have tax-advantaged health savings accounts. We should let them buy prescription drugs across state lines and insurance across state lines, prescription drugs from Canada. That's fine. If people want to do that, they should be allowed to do that. Otherwise, it's just the nanny state, and that goes directly to the cost of health insurance. On retirement, I think people should be allowed to have, again, tax-advantaged individual retirement accounts so they can save themselves.
We do have those.
Well, if you have the tax advantage, then it's more of an incentive to the individual to take matters in their own hands. You're referring to
your 401ks, right? Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Well, we should.
So the president is increasing the debt by $8 trillion. If you want to deal with that, you have to come up with $8 trillion in spending cuts, don't you?
Well, that's his 10-year budget.
Right, I understand. Yeah. But, I mean,
that would be child's play, seriously. Having just done a state budget for two terms, I know that you can make changes. Every governor in the United States is required to file a balanced budget. That's not true in Washington, and I've long contended we should have a constitutional requirement of a balanced budget for the federal government as well. Every household does understand, I think, you can't spend more than you take in.
So before we move on to foreign policy, most Republicans will say, if you ask them, well, what has Donald Trump done that you like the most? They will immediately say judges, Supreme Court justices. What would a President Wells approach be?
Well, I think they'd get the benefit of tax cuts. I cut tax cuts.
No, I'm going to start with the judges. What kind of judges would you have?
Well, I think both the judges were highly intelligent. I don't think I would have a list from an organization, the Federalist Society or anybody else, saying, I'm going to choose from your list.
You would have supported Judge Gorsuch and
yes.
Kavanaugh.
I read up on all 26 of the finalists the first time around, and I remember saying to friends before the appointment was announced, I thought Gorsuch was the best.
Mm. Okay, so there's not a big. So let's switch to foreign, and maybe where we want to get into trade, your approach to trade.
Well, I'm a free trader from way back. I think it can be proved that free trade always benefits the United States because we have by far the most productive workforce in the world, much higher productivity than China even. So if there's free trade between countries, we're always going to get those high-wage jobs. We may lose some low-wage jobs, but we're going to get the higher-wage jobs, which is going to increase aggregate national wealth, which is something that I always, as a good capitalist, focus on. So on trade, I thought the president, then the candidate, Trump's declaration that we should not join the Trans-Pacific Partnership was beyond reason, and it turned out the reason was he didn't understand that China was not going to be a member.
He didn't understand
that. No, he didn't. And the whole point was to have a beachhead on the Pacific where China would not be at the table with 12 other nations. And, you know, he's not a reader, and he's not a student of history at all. And it doesn't help to not be a reader, frankly. So I thought, he doesn't understand that allies are good force multipliers for the United States. And since the end of the Second War, we've been so clearly the richest hegemonic nation that we've almost been able to buy supremacy, that is not always going to be the case. You know, pretty soon we're going to have someone else, namely China, that has an economy at least that's either the same size as ours or bigger than ours a few more years down the road. We're not going to be able to buy our way anywhere. We're going to need those force multipliers. In the Far East, the president seems almost willing to leave South Korea and Japan on their own as far as the nuclear threat from the North is concerned. And he alternates between praise of President Kim of North Korea for being a strong kid because he iced his own uncle, meaning killed, and iced his own brother. And the president expressed admiration for that, saying that showed that
he turned out so well.
Turned out so well. Such a nice boy.
Well, I mean, who has not murdered a relative with any aircraft gun? I mean, there but for the grace of God, we all would have done that, right?
But, I mean, look at who else President Trump admires around the world. Vladimir Putin, Viktor Orban in Hungary, who wants to take them out of the Western orbit into the Soviet orbit. You know, Andy McCabe from the FBI said, Mr. Trump may or may not be a Russian agent, but he might as well be because, you know, Vladimir Putin in his wildest dreams couldn't believe that an American president would say, we don't really need NATO.
You raise an interesting point because it's not just Putin. It is all of these Duterte in the Philippines
who kills people with pistols.
Yeah, and the president of Brazil who he's with this week. What is the fascination? Just switching off. What do you think his fascination is with?
I think he's insecure, and this is not polite, but I think he's an insecure bully. He's worried that he's a loser, which is why he's very quick to say of anyone else who comes anywhere near threatening him, he's just a loser, and she's just a loser, He doesn't want to confront the possibility that maybe he's a loser, so he likes to associate with strong people, bullies, I'm tempted to say other bullies. Most schoolyard bullies are insecure underneath it all, and I'm afraid that's a combination we might have here. The psychiatrist might say that the president is not just a narcissist, which I think is commonly agreed, but a malignant narcissist who's most happy when other people are losing. If you look at his history in Atlantic City...
This is not a reach.
No, this is not a reach. In Atlantic City, I think he went bankrupt 3 or 4 times. Every time he went to the big banks and said, give me more money or I'm going to walk. And if I walk, you're going to lose all your collateral. They said, yes, sir, 3 bags full. Here's 3 bags of much more money. And then businessman Trump said, the other thing is I want to stiff the vendors. They're getting 5 or 10 cents on the dollar. That's how we're going to have enough money to have more for you and more for me. Well, that's not too impressive, frankly. In the deregulatory area that he gets a lot of credit for,
sure.
The main target has been clean air and clean water, the cuts at EPA, and then the adjustments to Dodd-Frank to take away the protections for little people in case an event like 2008 should happen again. Again, the big banks are fine with what he's done, but the little people would not have the protections that were enacted after the 2008 disaster.
This is one thing that I think that both the left and the right seem to agree on, that the system is rigged. And many of the complaints even that Bernie Sanders would make or Elizabeth Sanders would make about the way the system is rigged actually ring true. Now, their ideas, their solutions are questionable. So let's talk about that. Well, first of all, before we get to the Dems, but I want to walk through what the Democrats are doing here. Should the House Democrats go ahead and impeach Donald Trump? Would you favor impeachment?
I had a fascination with the possibility of impeachment early on because I actually worked on the Nixon impeachment, again, as a young man in my 20s. So I'm familiar with exactly the grounds for that. And I would say to you that I think Mr. Trump in office has gone well beyond anything Mr. Nixon ever did in terms of contempt for and encouragement to disregard the rule of law. And at bottom, that's why Mr. Nixon was impeached. That and lying to the American people. And Mr. Trump is all over that in spades. So I thought maybe this is not such a bad idea. But impeachment is a political remedy, and the politics are not favorable because you're not going to get 67 votes in the Senate to remove Mr. Trump. So I've kind of changed my view there, and I kind of think that whole kettle of fish discussion should be postponed. We'll see how bad things get when the Manafort stuff all plays out, because I think that's taken an ugly turn recently with the increased sentences, ugly turn from the president's point of view. But right now, I think it would be too much of a distraction.
Well, I mean, one of the, of course, we have not seen the Mueller report yet, and you know, it's at some point we will. And one of the big questions, I think, is going to be this question of, is anyone above the law?
That was decided by the United States Supreme Court in 1974 in the United States versus Nixon, where Chief Justice Berger wrote, the president is not above the law.
But if the Justice Department concludes or sticks with that guideline that they are not going to indict a sitting president, then the only remedy would be the political remedy of Congress.
Well, you know, the statute of limitations for federal criminal offenses is 5 years, and if the president got another term, it would be 8 years. So you have to be able to file a sealed indictment to satisfy the statute of limitations. So in that sense, the president can be indicted. He just can't be, and I agree with this, he can't be hauled into federal criminal court to answer charges every single day, because we have to run a world out there. And you'd like to think that the president would play a role in that. But, you know, the same article of the Constitution that talks about impeachment says that in all cases, the president shall nonetheless remain liable for indictment, conviction and punishment according to law. That's Article 1 of the Constitution.
It's right there.
Section 3 is right there. Big as life. Yeah. So he's not as immune as he may think he is.
You're not the only Massachusetts candidate for president. Let's just run through your quick take. If you give me just like a little capsule critique of the Democratic candidate. So let's start with your home state, Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Well, I like Senator Warren. She's out there by herself in her view that jobs are created by the government. They're not created by the private sector. But I think some of her other ideas are at least creative. And I like her. I like her personally. You know, I don't think I want to run through the whole gamut here. The one thing I would say is that they seem scared of the left wing of their party.
Very much so.
Just as the Republicans are scared of Mr. Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not good either. That might mean that a left wing Democrat would get the nomination, and that would be the way to reelect President Trump, for sure.
Yeah, there's no question about it. In fact, I was just tweeting out a column by Henry Olson. I often disagree with Henry, but I think he's absolutely right that if you have a Republican Party that moves to the left, look at the state-by-state polls. This is the formula for Trump to be reelected.
A
Democratic Party, because his share of the vote will be considerably higher than his very low approval rating at this particular point.
I think that's right. The president was right when he said in his State of the Union address, America is not a socialist country and never will be. I think it's a slightly right of center country. Certainly when you compare us to Europe, we are right of center.
So who's the strongest Democrat, do you think?
I don't think that's my place to say.
All right. So why are you not doing what Howard Schultz is doing? How would you differ from – how would you distinguish yourself from Howard Schultz?
I approve of what Howard Schultz is doing. Everyone else is dumping all over him. I think that's very short-sighted. I like to hear from pro-business Democrats, which he is. Mike Bloomberg would have been a very interesting candidate, and he's certainly a pro-business, very knowledgeable Democrat, and I think would have been a great candidate. He just was concerned that him getting in might reelect Donald Trump, so we wouldn't have two more years of him. We would have six more years of him. And the former head of U.S. term limits in me writhes at that thought.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other argument that can be made is that his candidacy serves as a warning to the Democrats not to move so far left, because were they to nominate somebody from the left wing of their party,
he would sink them.
Exactly. Yeah. And then suddenly his candidacy becomes very, very prudent. Okay, so let's talk about – we've talked about the Republicans, the Democrats. So what would day one, President Bill Weld, after you got up and were very, very surprised to be president?
No, I wouldn't be as surprised as Mr. Trump. I always expect to win.
Okay, let me ask you this. So what – in the New Hampshire primary, what percentage of the vote would be, wow, that is really successful?
Well – you know, I aim to win the New Hampshire primary. It's a small state. I'm in tune with the voters there. There is a certain liberty-oriented streak in that state, which is very friendly to me, and vice versa. So I don't think that's out of the question. Historically, people who Eugene McCarthy got 40%, knocked Lyndon Johnson out of the race. Pat Buchanan got 30-something percent. He didn't knock Bush 41 out of the race, but that was the beginning of the erosion of Bush 41's support. And Bush 41, in December of 1991, which was 2 months before the New Hampshire primary, his approval rating was 91%. And that included both Republicans and Democrats. 91%. They said at the time he has everyone except the broccoli farmers, because he'd said, "I don't like broccoli. I'm president of the United States. I'm not going to eat broccoli." And that all dissipated. I think, you know, people say, how can President Trump go from a high 80s or an 80% approval rating among Republicans? Well, that's not as high as the 91% that George W. H.W. Bush had in both parties. And I don't think there's a good answer to a lot of the analysis and criticisms that I've been leveling at Mr. Trump. So I think over time, you know, people, the sober second thought of the community is going to kick in, and people are going to begin to think. I mean, a year is a long time.
So that 1968 analogy with Eugene McCarthy seems to be one that comes up because, of course, he was not well known. Nobody thought that he had a chance.
No.
And he stepped up because nobody else would.
Right.
He wouldn't have run if Bobby Kennedy, you know, was not hiding out in the tall weeds.
That's right.
Until Johnson's
right.
vulnerability was obvious.
No, the same thing happened with Estes Kefauver and Harry Truman. Same thing happened when Ted Kennedy challenged Jimmy Carter. Mm-hmm. Same thing happened when Ronald Reagan challenged Gerry Ford, and then Bush 41. So five times since the beginning of the New Hampshire primary, which is 1952, the modern primary, five times there's been a primary challenge to the president. Those presidents have all lost.
Okay, so
five other times there was no primary challenge to the president, and they all coasted to reelection.
So we know what President Trump is like. We can imagine what a President Warren would be like. So let's go back to that question. What does a president well do that's different?
Well, first of all, I'm very welcoming. You know, my cabinet, my second term, was 8 women and 3 men. Always had minority members. I spent a lot of time with the African-American community, the Hispanic community, the Asian community, both East Asian and South Asian. I got 50.1% of the vote when I was elected for my first term. I got 71% of the vote in Massachusetts when I was reelected for my second term. So I think that shows that, you know, people appreciated the outreach and the belief that I have in everybody, which Mr. Trump does not have. He's a great divider. It is pretty obvious. I'd take off after the economic stuff right away. Job creation is key. The best social program anybody ever invented was a job. And I'd sit down with the best economic minds I could find and say, what are we going to do to maximize the number of high-wage jobs that we have? What are our soft spots, like I mentioned before, the five factors that are going to attack us? And what can we do about it? And let's go do it. And, you know, if the federal government links arms with the states instead of being a nanny state and giving them unfunded mandates and telling them what to do, there's a lot that could be done. And I think the education area is a shining example there. Then I would try to do targeted tax cuts to I think we should abolish the death tax. All it is a penalty on people who work hard all their life on their family business or their family farm. I think we should get the capital gains tax down to 10% to be competitive with jurisdictions like Hong Kong, and that would attract capital to the United States and American companies. But I'd be thinking about national wealth. You know, someone once asked Ted Heath, the Prime Minister of Britain, how can you be a Tory? You know, your father was a grocer or a butcher. And he says, I like the emphasis on aggregate national wealth. You know, I think that's not a bad thing to focus on.
But I
believe in spreading that wealth, too.
So are you enjoying this?
Yeah, I do enjoy it.
You enjoy campaigning, don't you?
Well, I do. And I know exactly what I think about the great issues of the day, because I've been doing it for a while, and I'll always tell you. And, you know, none of my views are outrageous. They're sort of constructive, and I have a good time with it. Happy warrior, the Hubert Humphrey phrase, that's not an inappropriate term to apply to me.
So are you in this all the way? What if, say, Larry Hogan gets in the race?
No, no. That would just be an interesting and probably positive development. Then we would get to debate. It would look more like an ordinary year with ordinary number of candidates being attracted. And it could be that whoever prevailed in that, assuming Mr. Trump hid out and would not debate anybody, maybe then that person would be the giant killer and could go on and have a better run.
So you're not a stalking horse for somebody else.
No.
You intend to be on the ballot there at the end in the New Hampshire primary.
Yeah, that's right.
Governor Bill Weld, thank you so much for coming
in and talking.
Charlie,
my pleasure.
We appreciate it. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.